Welcome. I'm glad you're here. This is Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton, using the Project Gutenberg edition, read slowly, aloud, and in company. These readings aren't lectures, and they aren't explanations. They're an invitation to listen carefully, to follow an argument that wanders on purpose, and to allow surprise to do some of the work. So let's take our time and see where Chesterton leads us today. Last time, we experienced the paradox of madness. Today, we walk with Chesterton as he begins to explore the edges of sanity. With Chesterton, we pause to consider whether the delusional person is really unreasonable, or whether something else may be at work. Western culture prizes productivity, independence, and confidence. We are quick to admire industry as proof of fulfillment. We are more apt to encourage our youth to pursue a business degree than an English degree. But is that encouragement rooted in human flourishing or in economic gain? Could it be that we have mistaken busyness for health, certainty for sanity? What would happen if humanity were to discover that some of what we call success is actually a quieter form of instability? With that tension in mind, let's listen to Chesterton.
Let us begin, then, with the madhouse. From this evil and fantastic inn, let us set forth on our intellectual journey. Now, if we are to glance at the philosophy of sanity, the first thing to do in the matter is to blot out one big and common mistake. There is a notion adrift everywhere that imagination, especially mystical imagination, is dangerous to man's mental balance. Poets are commonly spoken of as psychologically unreliable, and generally there is a vague association between wreathing laurels in your hair and sticking straws in it. Facts and history utterly contradict this view. Most of the very great poets have been not only sane, but extremely businesslike. And if Shakespeare ever really held horses, it was because he was much the safest man to hold them. Imagination does not breed insanity. Exactly what does breed insanity is reason. Poets do not go mad, but chess players do. Mathematicians go mad, and cashiers, but creative artists very seldom. I am not, as will be seen, in any sense attacking logic. I only say that this danger does lie in logic, not in imagination. Artistic paternity is as wholesome as physical paternity. Moreover, it is worthy of remark that when a poet really was morbid, it was commonly because he had some weak spot of rationality on his brain. Poe, for instance, really was morbid, not because he was poetical, but because he was specially analytical. Even chess was too poetical for him. He disliked chess because it was full of knights and castles, like a poem. He avowedly preferred the black discs of draughts because they were more like the mere black dots on a diagram. Perhaps the strongest case of all is this, that only one great English poet went mad, Coperre. And he was definitely driven mad by logic, by the ugly and alien logic of predestination. Poetry was not the disease, but the medicine. Poetry partly kept him in health. He could sometimes forget the red and thirsty hell to which his hideous necessitarianism dragged him among the wide waters and the white flat lilies of the Ouse. He was damned by John Calvin. He was almost saved by John Gilpin. Everywhere we see that men do not go mad by dreaming. Critics are much madder than poets. Homer is complete and calm enough. It is his critics who tear him into extravagant tatters. Shakespeare is quite himself. It is only some of his critics who have discovered that he was somebody else. And though St. John the Evangelist saw many strange monsters in his vision, he saw no creature so wild as one of his own commentators. The general fact is simple. Poetry is sane because it floats easily in an infinite sea. Reason seeks to cross the infinite sea, and so make it finite. The result is mental exhaustion, like the physical exhaustion of Mr. Holbein. To accept everything is an exercise, to understand everything a strain. The poet only desires exaltation and expansion, a world to stretch himself in. The poet only asks to get his head into the heavens. It is the logician who seeks to get the heavens into his head. And it is his head that splits. It is a small matter, but not irrelevant, that this striking mistake is commonly supported by a striking misquotation. We have all heard people cite the celebrated line of Dryden as, "Great genius is to madness near allied." But Dryden did not say that great genius was to madness near allied. Dryden was a great genius himself, and knew better. It would have been hard to find a man more romantic than he, or more sensible. What Dryden said was this: "Great wits are oft to madness near allied." And that is true. It is the pure promptitude of the intellect that is in peril of a breakdown. Also, people might remember of what sort of man Dryden was talking. He was not talking of any unworldly visionary like Vaughan or George Herbert. He was talking of a cynical man of the world, a skeptic, a diplomatist, a great practical politician. Such men are indeed to madness near allied. Their incessant calculation of their own brains and other people's brains is a dangerous trade. It is always perilous to the mind to reckon up the mind. A flippant person has asked why we say, "as mad as a hatter." A more flippant person might answer that a hatter is mad because he has to measure the human head. And if great reasoners are often maniacal, it is equally true that maniacs are commonly great reasoners. When I was engaged in a controversy with the Clarion on the matter of free will, that able writer, Mr. R. B. Southers, said that free will was lunacy because it meant causeless actions, and the actions of a lunatic would be causeless. I do not dwell here upon the disastrous lapse in determinist logic. Obviously, if any actions, even a lunatic's, can be causeless, determinism is done for. If the chain of causation can be broken for a madman, it can be broken for a man. But my purpose is to point out something more practical. It was natural, perhaps, that a modern Marxian socialist should not know anything about free will. But it was certainly remarkable that a modern Marxian socialist should not know anything about lunatics. Mr. Southers evidently did not know anything about lunatics. The last thing that can be said of a lunatic is that his actions are causeless. If any human acts may loosely be called causeless, they are the minor acts of a healthy man. Whistling as he walks, slashing the grass with a stick, kicking his heels or rubbing his hands. It is the happy man who does the useless things. The sick man is not strong enough to be idle. It is exactly such careless and causeless actions that the madman could never understand. For the madman, like the determinist, generally sees too much cause in everything. The madman would read a conspiratorial significance into those empty activities. He would think that the lopping of the grass was an attack on private property. He would think that the kicking of the heels was a signal to an accomplice. If the madman could for an instant become careless, he would become sane. Everyone who has had the misfortune to talk with people in the heart or on the edge of mental disorder knows that their most sinister quality is a horrible clarity of detail, a connecting of one thing with another in a map more elaborate than a maze. If you argue with a madman, it is extremely probable that you will get the worst of it, for in many ways, his mind moves all the quicker for not being delayed by the things that go with good judgment. He is not hampered by a sense of humor or by charity or by the dumb certainties of experience. He is the more logical for losing certain sane affections. Indeed, the common phrase for insanity is in this respect a misleading one. The madman is not the man who has lost his reason. The madman is the man who has lost everything except his reason. The madman's explanation of a thing is always complete, and often in a purely rational sense, satisfactory. Or, to speak more strictly, the insane explanation, if not conclusive, is at least unanswerable. This may be observed specially in the two or three commonest kinds of madness. If a man says, for instance, that men have a conspiracy against him, you cannot dispute it except by saying that all the men deny that they are conspirators, which is exactly what conspirators would do. His explanation covers the facts as much as yours. Or if a man says that he is the rightful king of England, it is no complete answer to say that the existing authorities call him mad. For if he were king of England, that might be the wisest thing for the existing authorities to do. Or if a man says that he is Jesus Christ, it is no answer to tell him that the world denies his divinity, for the world denied Christ's.
I love projects, but my problem is knowing where utility ends and the infinite horizon of imagination begins. I will design a project, say a desk, four legs, and a top. Well, why not add adjustable legs so I can raise it into a standing desk? That would be healthier. To do that, I need to mount my computer on a rack, reroute the wiring. And while I'm at it, perhaps I should add a monitor arm rather than leave the screen on the desk. As long as I'm doing that, what about adding X and then Y or even Z? Soon the details and the logic multiply. The design becomes more elaborate than the desk requires. Eventually, frustrated and bored with my own endless cycle of design and implementation, I abandon the whole thing and settle down to another cup of coffee. Logic and detail, the engines of modernity. But are they the engines of happiness? Chesterton writes, "It is the happy man who does the useless things. The sick man is not strong enough to be idle." That line unsettles me. Can it be that idleness, at least the kind that whistles, wanders, and wonders, is not weakness but health? Can an idle mind be an imaginatively engaged mind? Is this why Christian orthodoxy has always insisted on the Sabbath, on stillness, on time that is not productive but receptive? Is the image of God also reflected through not only engagement in creating, but the ability to rest? Next, we trade the conspiracy of one man for the tidy cosmos of an age and see which feels smaller. Let's meet again in a couple of weeks. Until then, God bless and be well.